I'm delighted to be joined tonight, guys, by a lady that is going to be talking about a condition we've not covered here on the Chronic Pain Club before. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about a new autoimmune disease to me anyway, and I'm sure to some of you in the audience. And we'll be talking about how they use art as a way of coping with that condition, and also the really long journey that they had to getting a label for it. So without further ado, guys, I'd like to welcome in Tracy Jallow. Tracy, hopefully by magic, you can see me and hear
that
me.
That is an icebreaker and a half. So as you know, my laptop didn't work. I was trying to use my laptop, so I had to switch to the phone. And I thought I'd be clever, plug it in, make sure there's enough battery, yeah? In this temperature, it overheated. And it said, you cannot use your phone until it cools down. I'm quickly trying to email you. I can't.
It's fine. You are the only person who knows how long I just filled for. So hopefully it wasn't too obvious for everyone else in the audience.
Oh, well done. Like I said, the gremlins are out tonight and it's a brilliant icebreaker. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for joining us. I know it's been a long time coming. I think when you got in touch, it was right when we'd just like booked up a slot of like 3 months. So thank you for being so patient for joining us. And before we maybe get stuck into all like the health side, do you just want to maybe just let people know in the audience sort of who you are, where you're from, maybe if you want to share what you do or whatever before we sort of get stuck into the medical side of things?
Yeah. So I'm Tracy Jallow. I'm from South London. I am a person living with antiphospholipid syndrome. And believe me, when you're diagnosed with that, you soon learn how to spell that word and how to say that word. It is also known as other things, sticky blood, Hughes syndrome, sludge blood, I've heard. Feel free to come up with any other names. But I do have a paid job. So I work for the government. I just have sort of like a personal assistant role in the government. But within the government, I am co-facilitator of a pain support group. And it started off as a sort of like musculoskeletal group. But when I joined it, because that's the only place that I felt I fitted out of all the support groups that we had, I realized it didn't encompass everybody. And so we've widened that group to, cover off fibromyalgia, lupus, all other types of pain as well. So we now have 300 members in that group across the UK. And they too, they love our group. I'm also an expert patient for King's College Musculoskeletal Group. And I got invited to be one. I knew a professor there. And we'd written about my journal in the British Medical Journal. And she invited me to be an expert patient. And I'm also a patient educator. So I teach year two students a few times a year, cultural competence. And I actually get involved in an art and pain module, which is a special study component. Not all medical students do, but some might choose that as an extra thing. So that's a bit about sort of like a vague outline of who I am and what I do.
I've got so many questions about all the stuff you're involved in there, and there's a lot of similarities in the patient involvement stuff. So hopefully we get time to, if I forget, remind me to circle back around to ask about some of those things. First of all, I'm very grateful that you pronounced antiphospholipid syndrome first, because I was convinced if I'd done it in the intro, I was going to trip up all over it. So do you want to maybe tell us I've definitely heard of it from the sticky sort of blood reference, but that was about as far as my knowledge goes. So assume there's other people here that have maybe not come across that. Before we get into how you got that diagnosis, how long it took, the damage it done and everything, do you want to maybe just sort of give us an overview of that condition?
Yeah, so it was only discovered in 1987, I believe. So as you can understand, in the medical world, that's still quite new. And compared to actually when I showed my first symptoms, which was in 91, just 4 years after they discovered it, I'm not actually that surprised that I went so long without being diagnosed. Nowadays, most doctors and nurses have heard of the condition. But what it is, it's an autoimmune condition, and our body makes antibodies that attack our blood and make our blood thick and sticky. If you think about blood, blood serves every part of the body. So the condition literally can affect any part of the body. Major symptoms would be strokes, but I haven't had a stroke, blood clots, pregnancy loss, and you get brain fog, fatigue, joint pain.
Yeah, so there is that sort of like some of them autoimmune sort of familiarities, the brain fog and the fatigue and the pain and everything. But there's also some real serious elements as well to that, isn't there? That and I suppose we should probably step back to your diagnosis journey, because I'm going to assume that there were some of those symptoms there that got you to this point. So where did that all start for you? And dare I ask, how long ago was that before you sort of got answers?
So I can trace it back to 1991 in my first pregnancy. I do believe that it can be triggered from pregnancy as well. Luckily, I didn't lose my baby, but I was very ill during the pregnancy. I was admitted to hospital several times, but everybody couldn't find anything, you know. Pregnancy, the baby was 1 week early, but other than that, I had a really good birth. So my daughter arrived. The only thing, looking back, that I had symptoms of was forgetfulness. But being a new mum, and I know you're a dad, lack of sleep, couldn't remember things. I just put it down to being a new mum. But if we fast forward between 91 and 99, and that's when I next got pregnant, even though we were trying. So doctors do believe that I could have had early miscarriages in between, although I wouldn't have known that they were miscarriages. The second pregnancy was even worse. And immediately after I gave birth to my son, I was extremely sick. Nobody knew what the problem was. Eventually, after 3 weeks, they got me back into hospital. And through exploratory tests, they realized my bowel had burst and I had a resection. I was in intensive care. I was very, very poorly. So that's an 8-year gap. But again, they were both in the pregnancies that I sort of like was not feeling well. Then, sorry, I do have a list because it's such a long list. So I want to get it right. then after the bowel resection, being in intensive care, I was discharged from hospital. I was home for a few days and I had problems breathing. They rushed me back into hospital and suspected pulmonary embolism was diagnosed. They treated it at the time, but there was no talk of like going on warfarin or anything to thin my blood. They discharged me. So going forward, I was having continuous pain in my stomach. I was putting it down to the bowel resection. I remember being in a job that I was doing at the time and I was in so much pain, I would literally go out to the staff room and lie on the floor and just like have to wait and ride the pain, and then I'd go back. And actually, when I look back and think of everything that I was going through, but I was just like dealing with it and I didn't actually realize that it meant something. I just thought it was all down to the bowel op, or I got irritable bowel when I was being a bit of a baby. But actually, no, it's very possible that I was clotting off my kidney at that time. I was in and out of hospital with pain. One time they told me, oh, your portal vein has thrombosed, but it's okay, your blood's rerouted. Nobody ever delved into why that was happening to a young girl in her 30s. I was just discharged and told it was okay. So I was flying as well. We all know, even if you're healthy, flying is very, very dangerous for blood clots. So I'd been away and I'd come back and my leg had swollen and I was having pain walking. And I thought, oh, I might have a blood clot. I better go to the doctors. And they did take me seriously and they referred me to a vascular surgeon to go and see a vascular surgeon to see what was going on. He too said there was something going on and that I had managed to clot off both of my popliteal arteries. Now, the popliteal arteries, for people that don't know, are your main arteries behind your knee that the blood goes down to the feet. So he then referred me to a haematologist, and I met a lovely haematologist, Dr. Professor, actually, Beverly Hunt, and at St. Thomas's Hospital. And she said, I don't know what's the matter with you, but I'm going to get you into hospital and I'm going to get you a diagnosis. So she got me into hospital and all the students were coming to see me. And within 5 days, they did lots of tests, angiograms, looking at the blood supply to my stomach. During one of those tests, they asked me when I clotted off my kidney. And I said, I didn't know I'd clotted off a kidney. So all this internal damage was going on. But she did then diagnose me with antiphospholipid syndrome. And ever since I've been diagnosed, touch wood, I've had no more clots. I'm on blood thinners. But the problem is the damage from the misdiagnosis, the undiagnosing has sort of like caused pain.
And so that's a significant period of time to be living with something as serious.
17 years. I thought I was going crazy.
Yeah,
I can imagine. I absolutely thought I was going crazy. And I was just getting on with it. And I just kept thinking, there's nothing wrong with me. Is there something wrong with me? Yes, there is. No, there's not. Like I said, I was in and out of hospital so many times. And they're sort of like, find nothing, send me home. Find nothing, send me home. It wasn't, I never felt disbelieved, but it was just that they weren't finding anything. And for me, there was a couple of times where I think it could have been found. So when I was in hospital and they said your portal vein has thrombosed, they should have been saying, why has this happened to this young lady? I was only in my early 30s, and they should have run some tests. I also had a gallbladder removal as well at one time, because they thought the pain was that. And I did have gallstones, so it wasn't taken out unnecessary. But the surgeon came to see me the next day, and I remember the words so clearly at the time. And he said, your blood was acting really weird. But it meant nothing to me at the time. But those words I remember so clearly. And now I look back and think, that was the antiphospholipid syndrome. It was clotting on him, I think. And you know, it's very dangerous for somebody to have an operation with antiphospholipid syndrome. There's measures that need to be put in place. You have to have Clexane injections, which is a different form of a blood thinner, but it leaves the system much quicker. So you would have that before an operation. They would stop it, I think, maybe 12 hours before the operation. Then as soon as you've had your operation, I think, they reintroduce the Clexane so you can go back onto your medication.
Yeah, that must have been so frustrating. And I think the thing is, you know, we hear a lot of experiences on this show, and in the autoimmune field in particular, that comes back with nothing, or we draw a blank, or they miss it. It's just such a theme, and we know it's an absolute minefield. But for the individual that's then having to go through that, particularly for someone as long as you, for all of those years of not getting an answer, that must have took its toll on more ways than just the physical. Like, obviously it's done clear damage internally, but how did that affect, you know, you mentally trying to
so mentally, I truly believe that sort of like I'm quite strong mentally, otherwise you wouldn't have got through that. And I was just like, soldier on, soldier on, soldier on, soldier on, nobody's finding anything, soldier on. So I just soldiered on, and I'm still like quite a positive person, mostly positive person. Like I said, for me, getting a diagnosis, I was elated. I was so happy. Like, a lot of people actually are quite upset getting a diagnosis, but I was so happy because I had a name and I actually was ill. I mean, I'd had time off of work, and even though work had been supportive, like I said, nobody disbelieved me, but it was me more that disbelieved myself and yeah. Wondering, do they really believe me? So to have a name to tell people, oh, I've got antiphospholipid syndrome. So at least I had a reason and I had something to tell them. And in turn, I thought, right, okay, this has happened to me. There's nothing I can do about what has happened, but there is something that I can do about the future. I genuinely want no one to have to go 17 years for a diagnosis. Like I said, it's getting better all the time. But when I was diagnosed, it was 2008. And, you know, we're a good decade or so on now, and it's even more now. But at the time, generally not many people knew what antiphospholipid syndrome was. So I started posting on social media, started talking to everybody I met, the poor woman that I met at the bus stop, telling her what antiphospholipid syndrome was. Just telling everybody, look, this is the condition I've got, and this is what it does. I've always been vocal. And one of the reasons that I'm vocal is it's an invisible illness. And that is the hardest part for me to deal with. I worked with a disabled gentleman at work who's in a wheelchair, and he'd often turn around to me. He's like, Tracy, he goes, I feel for you. He goes, nobody can see what you're going through. People look at me, they make way, they understand, they help me out. But like, anybody looking at you won't know unless you tell them.
And it is that you touched upon earlier, but it is why so many people that come on here and talk about autoimmune conditions feel like a fraud or imposter. They use these sort of words. And as someone who myself grew up for years and having their arthritis never showing blood tests, it's a weird feeling. And then to get a name for it, people never understand. Like, I remember someone saying to me, well, what does it matter? I had a doctor say to me, it doesn't matter. Why does that change? You know, if you're on the drugs already, what does it change? I said, well, I know my enemy. I know what I'm fighting. I also know that all those sort of mental battles that you have where you sort of think, well, what's going on here? And am I making it up? Or, you know, or whatever those thoughts you're having, having a label for it suddenly just, I don't know, it gives you some validation, doesn't it?
Yeah, years ago, when I worked in HR, I heard of fibromyalgia for the first time, and somebody explained to me what it was. I was like, they're making it up. They can't be in that much pain. So I've done it myself. Like, and now, because I'm experiencing it, it's not karma, but I'm experiencing it now.
Okay.
Like, I understand sometimes why people don't understand it, because unless you've walked in those shoes, it can be hard to understand that even just like walking 10 steps can be painful for you. I know you suffer with your hip as well as I suffer with my hip. My hip pain sometimes is unbearable. Even sitting can hurt. Sit, stand, lie down. There's sometimes no relief, whatever position that you're in. But I can understand why some people wouldn't understand it. That's why I'm so vocal about it. So that hopefully people that hear it and hear it and hear it and hear it, it becomes acceptable and understandable with these invisible illnesses.
Yeah. And just quickly before we get on to the, like, clearly you turned to that side of things, the awareness thing, really quickly, which is awesome. Just before you got to that, sort of, we get to that point, what was the impact on all of this on like those around you? Like, you know, you said you've got a family and everything, like going that long with all of these unknowns and times in intensive care or whatever that looked like must have taken its toll.
So I'm so lucky. My family are brilliant. My family have never doubted me. And if anybody kept me sane, it was my mum, by saying, no, I believe you. I know you're real. They're going to find it that you are real. Obviously, I was very poorly with a young baby. And I'm actually a single parent. So my 8-year-old would be helping me quite a lot. And you would have like guilt complex about those type of things. I've had many friends, such a good network of friends that have supported me, helped me, understood me. But yeah, it's hard. Like at one point before my condition was under control, to get up every day and go into work, I literally don't know how I did it. I look back and I think, how did I do that? The brain fog that I was experiencing back then was 100 times worse than the brain fog I have now. And it's like your head is wrapped up in cotton wool and it's like all muffled. And like, you don't even know, you got to think hard to put your foot in front of your other foot to even walk. That is much better controlled now. And I do look back and they say that you do this with a lot of things. You look back and think, how did I do that? But you do it. You have no choice. You do it. And I'm a survivalist. And a lot of my consultants, I've had 3 different consultants ask me how I'm still alive. And I genuinely believe it's down to spirit sometimes.
Yeah. But you find strength, you just didn't know. You have, like, I will often, I'll be the first to take the social media when I'm having a bad day, because I think it's important for people to see when you do struggle and have a sort of weakness, or, and I'll talk about the mental stuff. But then I have to then remind myself the stuff we go through in our world, don't we? And, like, you know, yours is obviously much more life-threatening than what I deal with. But, like, when that's that constant pain, or when children are involved and that guilt, I think you even said the word guilt, the guilt that you feel as a parent on those days where you're having to sort of pick and choose the sort of daily tasks you can do. It takes a special sort of mental strength that you don't realise you have until you're in that place, doesn't it?
My children actually understood. So if we were planning an event and sort of like, I know that you really understand this, I would say, if I'm well, on Friday, we're doing this. If I'm well, on Saturday, we're doing this. And they totally understood. I mean, my son grew up with it. My daughter maybe had a few years up until she was 8, 9, where it wasn't very visible. But my children have grown up with it. They understand about it. Even now, my son recently took me to Burna Boy concert, and he's running ahead to the tube to get me a seat. He's like, run ahead, get her a seat. No, that's for my mom. Like... I am lucky. They do understand. And I'm lucky. That's, I know, I talk with a lot of people on our support group at work, and I know not everybody has their family. Some people's families don't even believe them.
Yeah, no, it is hard. And I think, like I say, it's what you expose to. And we've had very different views on that over the years in what I do and that people that will protect, whereas I'm very much about involving them. And then I think the thing is, like, you know, my boy's only 4, but the empathy I get back and the understanding I get back on those days where you do have to say, look, I know this is what the plans were, but we're going to park that, we're going to do something else, and you find other ways to do stuff and have fun as a family. And he sort of, he understands terms. He's mad at 4 years old. Like, he'll say, oh, we'll have a sofa day, or we'll have a floor play day, or whatever they refer to it as. And it's kind of like, you know, I think in the long run helps them. You don't expose them to all of the really horrible stuff that goes on behind closed doors in the dead of night, maybe when you're really struggling. But the day-to-day stuff, I think you're giving them the tools to help you, aren't you?
Well, my daughter works in midwifery now, and it's given her empathy and a greater understanding. It definitely, I think it can teach our children good life skills.
Yeah, definitely. So you've clearly done a brilliant job there. So you mentioned earlier about how you started talking to people about your condition, explaining what it was. That sounds like, oh my God, this wrong. That sounds like that come quite naturally to you. Was that quite a quick thing, or how did that sort of pan out?
So around 2012, she wasn't a professor then, a senior lecturer at King's College got in touch with me and asked me if I'd write my journey to diagnosis, the 17 years, and get into the British Medical Journal, which I was like, yes, I want more doctors to learn about this and actually see the different ways that people can present, because I didn't present in a natural way. And this is something that I teach medical students, don't always go by the textbook. So it can, you know, just holistically think outside the box sometimes. So it took us 2 years to and fro in between myself and this senior lecturer and a publisher at the British Medical Journal. And it came to a bit to a standstill, and we weren't getting replies from the British Medical Journal. And unfortunately, it turned out that the publisher had passed away that was dealing with us. And the lecturer said, no, we're going to get it published still. So she went through her contacts and we eventually got it published. And I said, that was amazing. I'm just so happy that I can put the word out there that, you know, I want other people to learn from this. It's happened to me. There's nothing we can do about it. But let me use my experience to help others. And we kept in touch and we met up for coffees every now and then. And she hadn't actually told me, but she ran a musculoskeletal expert patient group, and at the time they were all patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and she'd said, look, I want to open this out now and bring in other people. And she then approached me to come and join the group, and I've been there maybe about 5 years now, five, six years.
That's awesome. But also I want to give that medical professional a shout out to have, you know, to be able to say, look, this was a very long thing. It wasn't right. And you know, to then open the door for you, because as somebody that's hit a lot of brick walls around that whole, you know, people want to share the good and share the best use cases and all this sort of thing in the medical community. But for somebody to actually reach out to you and say, I want you to share that 17-year journey, I think that feels really fresh. And it must have been quite liberating for you as well, I imagine.
Yeah, I've like I said, when I got my diagnosis, I was elated anyhow. And it is liberating. I was doing it on my own before. I was just like probably annoying the hell out of people on Facebook. This is what antiphospholipids is. This is this. This has happened. That has happened. I have to go to the hospital every week. But it's very important. And, you know, I may even go on over posts. But I'm hoping that one of those posts one day might help them or a family member if something similar happens. And they could say, oh, that sounds like that happened to a lady I know. And, you know, the more that I talk about it is the more that people will learn. And I'm sure somewhere down the line, it's going to help someone.
Yeah, 100% is exactly the same reason why what brought me here on Sunday nights and all the other bits and about trying to, you know, you maybe don't get the initial, you know, reaction feedback that it helps someone, but somewhere down the line that information trickles down, and if it can make somebody, like I say, feel a little less alone or know where to go and get that information, you know, then you've done your job. And I'm sure you've done that 1,000 times over with the work you're doing. So what you mentioned, you do that, and you said about you're doing like the Facebook stuff, and we'll make sure we give lots of plugs at the end where people can find that. What other sort of like layers was there sort of to your advocacy? Because it sounds like you found that quite natural. Like, I know some people really struggle to find their voice. It sounds like you found that quite natural.
It's just because it's important to me. It is not particularly natural for me, in fact, to stand up in front of loads of people and talk. But because it's something that I'm very passionate about and I do want people to learn about, that's my driver. I mean, before we came on tonight, I was like, oh gosh, I'm nervous talking to people, da da da. But I knew you were very friendly. But you still get those nerves. But for me, it's really, really important to just get up and say it.
Yeah. And my wife is always reminding me, I'll say, why am I always every Sunday? Every single Sunday afternoon, I'm nervous. I let it ruin half my day of the weekend. And she's like, you're only nervous because you care. And she's always reminding me of that.
That is
you
true. Know. That is true. Yeah. And I had a coach once, and the coach told me, listen, you're the expert. Nobody else is going to know what you're talking about anyhow. Yeah. So, yeah. But it's natural. Nerves is a good thing anyhow.
Yeah, and it's also amazing on the flip side of that, though, what it enables us to go on to do. Like we talked about parenting and how you find that strength. I think, you know, I was never comfortable in front of a camera. I never pictured myself doing this sort of thing, as I'm sure you never pictured yourself standing up and talking to people. But it's amazing when you find that subject, that passion that means so much. And obviously in your case, it's so life-changing. What you're capable of, it's like finding a new skill, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, with the expert patient group, what we do is we have three patient, apart from during COVID, of course, three patient education evenings a year. And we do it in the lighter months and the warmer months so that people can come. So it's patients at King's College Hospital. They'll come along. We have guest speakers. We might talk about blood tests. We might talk about specifics, health and nutrition, different things. But more importantly is getting groups of people together and they can talk to other patients and actually realise that they're not alone. So we do the patient education evenings. I've been involved in some research papers as well, looking at the effect of exercise, helping fatigue. We do all different types of things. I've talked to a group in Patagonia, a mental health institute actually, and it was more about working with a disability and the types of things that an employer can do to support somebody that may have barriers in the workplace.
That's just amazing. And I don't know about you, I find the longer I do this, the more you realize there's ways you can sort of help, especially when telling your story, that you never pictured. Like, I know when I started getting asked to speak, it was like, okay, well, this will last a year. This is nice. I'll make the most of it. And then all of a sudden, there's all sorts of other creative ways. And you can see how I'm segueing here into sort of sharing your experience. And I can't ignore the pictures anymore in the background. For those that are listening back on the podcast, I will put some links so they can see your artwork for themselves. What brought you to art? And I suppose more importantly, my question is, what was the sort of time frame, like, you know, with you dealing with what you were dealing with, how did that look, you know, that transition to finding that creative outlet?
So I'd say that sort of like I'm a creative person naturally. I've always enjoyed creative things. I would have used to say that I can't paint and I can't draw, stick man, etc. But when I got diagnosed and I was off work, I'd been really poorly at the time around my diagnosis. I came home and I thought, I want to paint what this looks like to me. So I got my canvas, went online, ordered a few bits, ordered my paints, and I painted of how I saw my condition at that time. And I basically broke it down with the main symptoms. And if you want, you can share the slide. I don't know if you've got it.
Yeah, I'm being tested tonight because we've not done this before, but by magic. Look at that. I like coming out of my comfort zone, so that's good. So thank you for that, Tracy. So do you want to maybe talk us through this slide and the image we're seeing on screen?
Yeah, so the big red dot in the middle, the massive one, that was to do with my major clots that I've had, my bowel and my kidney. So losing my kidney and my bowel, they're two major organs that have been affected. So you can have these almost catastrophic clots. And then if people can see, there's smaller red dots. So they're more of the smaller sort of like clots that can happen in your arm, and you get a bit of swelling, or in your veins rather than your arteries. So that is the blood clots. Down the side on the left, you can see that wooden thing. That at the time for me, and like I said, I haven't actually had one, represented a stroke, like, you know, the rigidness and the lack of movement. So I popped that in. The black background is because I found the whole thing very dark. I'd only just been diagnosed and I was trying to digest how I felt about it and what it was, and, you know, doing all my Googling at the time about the condition. The bright orange is the pain, how I described pain at the time. And, you know, pain has literally been, you know, disabling to me, totally disabling, especially my stomach pain. I can literally be okay 1 minute and then I'm like, have so much stomach pain, it's unbelievable. It's more than IBS, it's more than a stomach ache. And what it is you have, I believe, 3 or 4 blood supplies to the stomach that digests food. And I've clotted off some of mine as well. So you can imagine on a daily eating food and the blood rushes to the stomach to digest that food is causing me major stomach aches. The teardrops represented fetal loss. So like I said, people actually can have stillbirths from it. So, you know, it's very sad. So I wanted to include white for the innocence of the loss of a baby. Like I said, I haven't experienced it myself, but I've got friends that have, so I do understand what they're going through. And then the brain fog, I was like, how can I do brain fog? It's just this gray cloud. So there above the clot, I did this gray cloud. So when I stepped back from it afterwards and I was looking at it, and I'd literally, there was no thought, rhyme or reason to what I was doing. I looked at it and I thought, that's a person. It's like a person running away. And I thought, that's right. You know, it's a condition that you wouldn't want to have and that you would run away from if you could.
I don't know, I'm sure people will let us know in chat how it feels for them, but for me, as someone who's like a layman, no experience in this stuff, who thought, you know, blood clots was just strokes or DVTs or whatever, and just you talking through that image has proper gut punched me over the seriousness and the impact and the life impact of that condition. You know, I think it really demonstrates how, you know, creativity, it's like my thing is words, you paint and draw, and I think it shows you how people can maybe get it on a level maybe they didn't understand, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier about sharing your stories in different ways. I think it's really powerful.
Once I'd painted it, I was able to sort of like put it down and walk away from it. I do feel, when you'll see later on with some of the other images that I have, that once I lay something down on a canvas, it's almost like I take it out of me and put it on the canvas so that I don't have to carry it around. And that is literally how I feel with the paintings that I'm doing from emotion.
Yeah, I can really relate to that, because there'll be times where a couple of days later I'll look back at poetry I've written and shared, and knowing that things like my parents and people like that's it, and think the Joel of 10 years ago would have never have been that open. But it is like, it's like taking something out and putting it in a different box and it's gone, and you can blow it away and move on a little bit, can't you?
Your poems are very good. I've been reading them these days.
Oh, really?
I do write a few myself as well. It's a good way.
I've seen it.
Yeah, it's a good way to just put it down on the paper or the canvas or whatever, and sort of like, you know, I've dealt with that, and sort of almost compartmentalize that feeling and thought and make room for other things.
Yeah, I'll have to remember that, by the way, because we had a guest on, Russ, earlier in the year, and we said about doing like a one show dedicated to different people reading poetry. So bring you back for that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing. And like I say, you talking that through is really like, I don't know, maybe just sit back and appreciate the realities there. And so, yeah, that's it just demonstrates
Some of my other paintings, which we go through, are actually going to talk about the reality of what I'm living with.
Super. Do you want me to jump to the next one? Anything more you want to say?
We're talking about reality, could you jump to number three, or does that confuse you too
much? No, not at all. No, I'm a well-oiled machine by this point. The regulars would say otherwise.
Okay, so these are three pieces that I've done, and if we start with the lady on the left, I woke up one morning and another friend had died from antiphospholipid syndrome, and that is something that I'm living with on a day-to-day basis. Like, you know, what I'm living with is life-threatening. It doesn't mean that it will be life-threatening, but it can be life-threatening. So on a day-to-day basis, and this is what makes me relish my life and love my life and do what I can in my life, because it's all going to be over one day for us anyhow. But I think being ill, really, they say that people that are ill really appreciate their lives and make the most of their lives. And actually, maybe I should look at myself as being fortunate, because I've truly lived my life since I've been in my 30s. So I've, you know, it was just like, I woke up and this lady, who happened to be my age at the time, had passed away from complications of antiphospholipid syndrome. And I just felt like I need to do something. I didn't know what to do. So it was more of a quick doodle, but I did it, put it down, and I felt mildly better. You know, it's like dealing with that emotion. And you do think about it a lot. I mean, people wouldn't know, but I think of death on a daily basis. And it's not because I'm morbid. It's because of the condition. Each Christmas that comes, each birthday that comes, each of my children's birthdays, like, I make it as good as possible, because like, it is not, I guess for anybody it's not guaranteed, but I feel that so strongly with my condition. With the best will in the world, you know, I have a lot of internal damage. I have kidney failure. As you get older, the one kidney I have is going to become weaker anyhow, naturally. So I'm dealing with the reality of what my condition can bring, and that is death. I mean, I don't go around being morbid, but it's nice actually to talk about it here, because you know how important mental health is, and you know, I know you're a big advocate of mental health, but this is sometimes some of the things that you don't go around talking about.
Yeah, and don't worry, this is a perfect place to share that, because grief is probably one of the most used words that we have come up here on Sunday night on these conversations, and whether that's like the, you know, face and death itself, or the grief over what you were, what you could have done, what you wish you could have done, all them sort of things come in, especially with autoimmune disease and it being so fluid and so unpredictable. So yeah, there's a lot of people in the audience, myself included, that can relate to that, and it isn't because you're morbid, it's just unfortunately it is right in front of you, whereas other people it's in the back of their mind, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So the painting on the right, I did a few weeks into COVID, when we didn't really know what was going on with COVID, and I just felt like I was that big smiley but gasping face in the middle, and everybody else is around, and the virus is just floating all around the space, we don't know where it is. I mean, having an autoimmune condition as well, it was very, very unclear at the beginning about like how that would affect us. And I truly thought, I mean, that first week when everything came out, I was like, I'm dead if I catch COVID. I've since had COVID and I didn't die, but there was a lot of propaganda at the time, a lot of like scaremongering, I think, that actually could have been done slightly different, but it is what it is, and we went through what we went through. I have had COVID, I was okay apart from being ill, and I know a lot of people weren't okay, but that's how I felt at the beginning of COVID. I was very worried and very anxious, what does this mean for me? I had to go to hospital every week during COVID, and they were telling people to stay away from hospitals during COVID. So I'm just like, I'm scared to go on the train, I'm scared to do this, I'm scared to do that. And I was doing that journey every week whilst we didn't actually know what was going on. So there was a lot of fear around those times. But also I got the chance to paint a lot. So pros and cons.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to capture those moments, because I look back at some of the stuff I wrote in that period and realised just how terrifying and dark and confusing it was for me. So even though I try not to, you know, because for a long while it's all we talked about on this show, so I try not to go back to that, those days, too much now, but I think it is really important to capture that, and you must find that with your artwork, it gets it out, but it also helps you sort of like maybe reflect on those sort of periods past as well.
And the one in the middle is I take a lot of medication. Probably people take more, but I think I'm on about 15 tablets a day. And in conversations with people, not very nice people, and I'm like, oh, I'm on this medication. That's too many tablets. Why are you taking that many? You don't need that many tablets. I'm like, yes, I do need that many tablets. So that this was all about medication, and that whilst it is my lifesaver, it also may be my killer, because medication is drugs. Drugs affect our bodies, but the drug also keeps me alive. It was me trying to think through those sort of thoughts. And actually, each time we take medicine, it changes our body. So this is all about different change and what it might do to our bodies. You know, it's doing good things, we hope, but it changes our bodies. And I might just show you one more, actually. It's up here. Can you see the scary lady?
Oh, yes, we can. That's very stand out, doesn't it?
So, as you may or may not know, so with anti-inflammatory diseases, your gums and your teeth are affected a lot. And I've happened to lose two teeth. I've had to have teeth removal because of the condition. And it is like my worst nightmare. Not because nobody likes the dentist. It's not necessarily going to the dentist. It is like losing another part of me. Mm-hmm. And I get so scared, or like, you know, the first was bad enough, then the second. So that was me hopefully bringing out my fear and pure shock and horror that this had happened to me. But like I said, again, you paint it, you put it on the paper, and you kind of dealt with it.
And that I hadn't spotted the face behind you, but now you've pointed it out. So
see, this is, people say, "Why have you got it on your wall?" I'm like, "It's important to me."
Yeah, no, that's all that matters. But going back to this one as well about the medication, I think it's a really important point you raised there, because you know, as somebody that's had to take some really strong, you know, chemo grade drugs since I was a kid and things like that, it's always in the back of your mind. It's like, you know, at what point do you cross over from the doing good to doing bad kind of thing? And I recently had a sort of experience of that, as some of the stuff I've taken for 20 years sort of having a real negative impact. And so again, I think just from that conversation starter, that's really important. Like, you obviously at the moment that captured your attention and you put it on a page, but I'm just thinking, like, for me, like, and the work I do, they're really important reminders, you know, that I'll look at a poem and it'll jog my memory to raise an issue, and you've got those images. So I think that's, yeah, it's really special, and that's a good point you raise on that one.
Yeah, so we can probably move on to a more positive one now, if you would like to. So this is called Indisposed Treasure, and I was invited in 2021 as part of the expert patient group. They gave us a little bit of money, and they got an NHS artist to work with us, and that we could all paint our condition. So it was a chance to paint my condition again. And I really thought about, we did like a workshop, then we went off and had time to paint, or, you know, do our bits and pieces. Some people wrote poetry, actually. Think about it. So what did I want to show people? So if I had a magic wand, as I've said already earlier, I would want people to see my illness, because they can't see my illness. And that would be my one wish, that they could see what I'm going through, just so that they understand. So understanding. And the second thing I wanted people to know is that I view it differently now. So have you heard of kintsugi?
No, I haven't.
So please. Kintsugi is a practice that they have in I want to say Asian countries, in case I get it wrong, but definitely one Asian company, maybe several Asian companies. And if they break a pot or a jug or a plate, they mend it with like a melted gold.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that's what it's called. I've seen the bowls that have been repaired like that. Yeah, I didn't know that was the name for it.
And they believe that it's more beautiful than its original state. So having done kintsugi, they believe the item that they have is better than it was before. And I believe that I'm a better version of myself because I've been ill. Like I said, I live life to the fullest. I understand what life is. I live life to the moment. So I tried to integrate the kintsugi into that with the gold leaf. I also wanted to see people, the pain that I still feel. So the red areas are all the pain, like literally head to toe pain for me. It may not be all at the same time, but you know, all of my body does hurt at some time. And I thought it was interesting that I look at it so differently now.
Yeah, that is, because there's definitely, I think I'm still going through like a bit of a grief cycle with mine, but there are definitely days where you look at it and you realize, you know, what how you grew as a person because of those challenges, or despite those challenges. You know, I really struggle with, a lot of people use the term thrive, and I struggle with that term because I always think, like, I could be a lot more without my long-term health conditions. But it's that kind of thing, isn't it? Where it's like, you know, it becomes part of you and you stop fighting it, and then you see the positive from it.
I know not everybody's like this, but I believe there's a reason for everything. And I know that I have helped people, and I know that I'm strong enough to cope with this. It is what it is. I can't change it. If I could change it, would I? I have to debate on that now, because like, I actually like the person that I am. So I know that a lot of people going through early diagnosis of antiphospholipid syndrome, I've been there for them. You know, it's given me opportunities. I'm a published author, for a start.
Congratulations.
I get to talk on shows like this with you. You know, all these opportunities have come along, and it's been insightful. And you said, does it come easy to me? And I said, no, but actually I love it. So that when you love something, you know that you're doing the right thing. You know you're doing what you're meant to do. So no matter how hard things may be for me, it's something like I literally overload myself to do this, but that's my choice because the mental relief that it gives me probably outweighs the physical pain that I may have from overloading myself.
I don't think I've met a single one of us advocates that hasn't said something similar, and that we know we go into the red for it, but we can't imagine coping without what we do now. You know, it's just it's like an escape, isn't it, from something you can't control. At least you can try and help other people. But I think you've just got such a great attitude. I'm sitting here thinking I could do so much more if I had your attitude, because I have my fair share of like doom and gloom days. Act a bit like a weight around my leg. So, and I'm sure you do as well.
We do too. Burner Boy, after my concert at Burner Boy, I couldn't move the whole day. The next day, literally just for the basics, toilet and food. That's it.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I literally had to take that day out to recover. And I do things, but I factor in, like, although I haven't traveled away since COVID, I've always factored in a rest day if I'm traveling. I know you're not so lucky when you go straight into EULA. It catches up with you and you just learn to do things in a different way, like my memory problems as well. So I use my calendar at work for everything. Do this, do that, do this, do that. As soon as I know something, and even tonight, you know, I think I was quite well organized, even though it went pear-shaped at the end. But, you know, I try to keep on top of things, like, so I don't forget.
Yeah, it does make you. I know my wife probably gets very frustrated with the amount of calendar entries she's getting copied in on. She has no idea why she needs a reminder about walking the dog late on a hot day or whatever that might look like. But it's just, unfortunately, it's how our brains work, isn't it?
I would like to tell you about one more symptom, actually, that I've missed out. So we often have something called, so not just cognitive dysfunction, word confusion. And I call it the Doc Cotton syndrome. We all know Doc Cotton used to get her words mixed up. So that is something that can happen with antiphospholipid syndrome. So if, for instance, you wanted to say the fat cat, you might say the cat fat. Mm-hmm. Your brain works really funny. But just a little funny story about my late father. One day I phoned him up and he's like, what did you have for porridge? I'm doing it now. What did you have for breakfast? And I said, oh, I had porn porridge. He said, porn for breakfast.
I'm intrigued as what he thought that might have been.
But we can laugh about it, but it can actually be quite embarrassing. And yeah. You feel like, like I look stupid. But like your brain just gets muddled.
And the thing is, it doesn't take a lot, I think, with us. Like, for me, it's all about my resilience and my confidence. If I'm having a high resilience confidence day, I can deal with so many more bumps in the road. And if you've got something like that, it might seem like a minor thing. And like you say, we laugh about it. But if that happens to fall on that day where you're having a bit of a wobble, it can be the difference between you leaving the house or not, or whatever, can't it? And yeah, it should never be underplayed.
And especially when people call you up over it, like they may not even realize what it is. It could be at work. They're like, oh, what are you talking about? And laugh. Yeah. But inwardly, like, and there's no malicious on it. They're just like, but inwardly, it's just like, that was harsh.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I can totally relate to that. Mine's more sort of like that on the physical side, but it's a minor inconvenience for us. But if someone points out, then that can be all the difference, can't it? But I'm conscious of your time because we were late bringing you in anyway, and we're already sort of hit the 45 minute mark. I've been so fascinated by this. I think we could have done a whole show just focused on the art as well, because that's amazing. If people want to see more of your art, where can they see that? Because the comments have been really amazing and positive about that.
So T Jallo, that's just my initial T Jallo on Instagram, T Jallo art, sorry, on Instagram. On Twitter, it's Tracy Jallo, LinkedIn, Tracy Jallo, and Facebook, Tracy Jallo Hutchinson.
Brilliant. Just keep everyone on their toes. We all have that issue of trying to get the same handle everywhere. For anyone that's watching this back, that isn't the live show and or is listening on the podcast, all of those links will be in the description and the show notes. So so feel free to check those out. Tracy, on behalf of everyone, that's been really eye-opening. I knew nothing about the condition. I refused to research it as well because I just wanted to hear, like, you know, your experience and not have any sort of preconceptions and everything. So thank you for being so open and candid. Thank you for all that you do as well for the community, because I don't think you probably downplayed the amount that you're involved in and the work that you do and the difference you'll be making to people. So thank you on behalf of the community for that as well.
I see you exactly the same way, Joel. You know, you inspire me. You genuinely do. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much, yeah, for joining. And please come back when we do our special poetry event.
100%.
I'll get you back because I had a couple of people remind me that I said we'd do that and we haven't done that yet. We'll get that in the diary.
Let's see that. Yeah. Lovely.
Brilliant. Tracy, thank you ever so much. Feel free to stick around in chat and answer any sort of comments or questions that are going on there. But I will release you now for the rest of your Sunday and enjoy the rest of the weather.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you. Bye.
And you. Bye-bye.